You're listening to RSJ Radio.
Good evening and welcome to News Night. I'm Rachel Arhin.
And I'm Ryan Tuchel. In tonight's top stories, Canadian music legend Leonard Cohen has died. Justin Trudeau is in Cuba today looking to get investment into Canada, and Donald Trump's unexpected win. Speaking of Donald Trump, Rachel, I remember when we were live on the air last week, most would never have predicted that he was about to become the next president of the United States.
I know. Last week, as election results were starting to come in, New York Times had Hillary Clinton at 88% chance of winning.
It was definitely a surprise when a few hours later we saw that Trump had taken a big lead. It remains to be seen how this will affect the international community moving forward.
You're right, Ryan, but we do have an idea of what's happening now.
That's exactly right. Donald Trump has been president-elect for 1 week. Since then, there have been ongoing protests across the U.S. and even some in Toronto.
According to an event on Facebook, there's another protest planned for this weekend at Nathan Phillips Square. Trump has released a plan for his first 100 days in office. He has been working on assembling the team that he will take to the White House. GOP Chief Rance Priebus will be Trump's chief of staff. His chief strategist will be Steve Bannon, an ex-Goldman Sachs banker and executive chairman of Breitbart News.
Breitbart News is commonly associated with the alt-right because it is a right-wing online media organization known to promote racially and religiously problematic rhetoric. As a result, Trump is facing demands to reverse his appointment of Bannon. According to The Guardian, U.S. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said that there must be no sugarcoating the reality that a white nationalist has been named to the position.
Former Mayor of New York Rudy Giuliani is in consideration for multiple cabinet positions, but according to CNN, he has his eye on becoming the Secretary of State. Ironically, the same position held by Hillary Clinton 4 years ago. The stock market response to the election has been more complicated than expected. According to the New York Times, investors think Trump administration will follow through on plans for growth and be cautious around policies with negative connotations.
In regards to how this affects Canada, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said in a press conference that he is not worried about Trump's presidency increasing competition for global investments.
I think one of the things we've seen is there is a tremendous amount of global capital that is looking for stable long-term investments. And Canada, with its economic, fiscal, political, social stability, is an extremely attractive place to do business, place to invest for global capital.
In light of Laxwee's election, many racist events are making news in Toronto. Last night, a white man was captured on video yelling racist insults and threats to a man with brown skin on a Toronto streetcar. Some of the language used in this video is shocking.
It's going to end with his teeth on the fucking ground. That's how it's going to end. You know what it is? These people think they have a right to assault us. I'm the racist.
These people?
I'm the racist.
It's not these
I'm
people.
I'm the racist.
Yeah, you're the racist.
Other instances of racism have also arisen in the city. Kayla McLaughlin wonders whether it is a result of the new president-elect Donald Trump and his views on immigration.
In a city as diverse as Toronto, it is difficult to imagine this happening. The man in the video asks the victim if he's stupid and says racial slurs such as, "He's not from around these towns. I can tell by his face." When the woman recording the video, Valeska Griffiths, called the man an effing racist, he responded with, "Go Trump." This isn't the only racist backlash we've seen in Toronto since Trump's election last week. Earlier yesterday, Toronto residents found at least half a dozen racist posters in a park in the east end of the city. The posters begin with, "Hey, white person," and said things such as, quote, "Tired of political correctness? Wondering why only white countries have become multicultural?" End quote. Are these the standards we've lowered ourselves to? In response to the recent election, the city should be expressing unity as opposed to segregation. For Newsnight, I'm Kayla McLaughlin.
Newspapers around the world have been honoring Montreal native Leonard Cohen. In an article published today by the Montreal Gazette, papers from the United Kingdom, Greece, and Israel have published front-page tributes. The Canadian singer, songwriter, poet, and novelist died last Monday. His work was cited as being an inspiration for many musicians and is frequently covered by current artists today. Perhaps his most popular song, "Hallelujah," has been covered and reimagined by countless artists. This past weekend, the song was covered by Saturday Night Live cast member Kate McKinnon. She performed the number by reprising her role as Hillary Clinton and ended the skit by saying, "I'm not giving up, and neither should you."
Today, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau arrives in Cuba. This is the first visit by a Canadian Prime Minister in almost 20 years. The visit is expected to improve trade and investment in the area and also to further Canada's role as a mediator between Cuba and the United States. As a part of Trudeau's week-long trade-boosting trip, he stopped in Toronto yesterday to speak to some of the world's most influential investors, advising them to invest in Canada, specifically a $180 billion infrastructure investment opportunity.
I'm not worried about competing. What I'm worried about is highlighting and putting forward the best possible understanding for people of just the ease of doing business in Canada, the long-term growth potentials here in Canada, the extraordinarily positive and educated workforce.
Many have gathered on Nathan Phillips Square today in protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline. Nikhil Sharma has the story.
The Dakota Access Pipeline may be south of the border, but people here at home are still concerned about negative effects it can have. The pipeline is expected to export 450,000 barrels of oil daily from North Dakota to Illinois. Many say it would damage the environment and surround cultural sites of tribal nations. Sacred Youngest, who recalls being arrested for chaining herself to the Enbridge fence at Westover, says she came to support her sisters.
It's about me using my voice now to make sure that the future generations of all people, not just First Nations, have water, clean water to drink and clean air to breathe in.
Suzanne Smoke, who led the dance and is a member of the Alderville First Nations, put out a call out for people to show support.
It's a worldwide day of action for Standing Rock. The youth have put that out there from Cannonball, and we wanted to come together in peace and prayer. And every time we do this, we're raising awareness. One other person knows about what's going on, and hopefully that's going to stop the violence, and that's really why we're here.
Shadow Hawk, who came from Saskatchewan's Stony Rapids, says they're fighting for water for future generations.
It's not just a native issue, it's a human thing.
There is no evidence to prove that the new oil pipeline would create further environmental problems. The United States does have the biggest pipeline network. Nikhil Sharma reporting for Newsnight.
A recent suicide by a mother in Shamattawa has First Nations leaders demanding a change. According to a Shamattawa band counselor, this suicide is a part of a long-standing crisis where the Northern Manitoba First Nation Reserve has seen 92 suicide attempts this year. Last year, there were 100 suicide attempts and 5 suicide deaths. The community was ravaged by a fire in September, which destroyed major sources of infrastructure, one of them being their only grocery store. They have been in a state of emergency ever since. The people of Shamattawa are looking for long-term solutions and support from government.
The RCMP has opened their doors to the Toronto Star and the CBC in an effort to argue that ineffective laws and diminishing police powers allow criminals to escape justice. The main problem, police say, is our digital age. They lack the resources to break through encryption, which makes it impossible to access the information needed to get a conviction in court. Privacy proponents argue that police have benefited from increases in surveillance and don't need more power. The RCMP want public input on the issue to find out what Canadians think the powers of the RCMP should be.
Prime Minister Justin Trudeau named Randy Boisanot an Edmonton MP, a special advisor on LGBTQ2 issues. Boisanot will advise Trudeau on the development of the government's equality agenda. This will include working with advocacy groups to promote equality for lesbians, gays, bisexual, transgendered, queer, and two-spirited people. The announcement comes as the government works to repeal a law which makes it illegal to have anal sex under the age of 18, unless it is between a husband and wife. The law is discriminatory in nature and violates equality rights, considering the age of consent for sexuality activity is 16.
Helicopter crews are starting to rescue 1,200 people stranded by a deadly earthquake in New Zealand on Monday. The 7.8 magnitude quake killed 2 people, triggering massive landslides that cut off vital supply lines. New Zealand's Prime Minister John Key said repairing the damage is estimated to cost billions of dollars.
So some very short-term practical issues that need to be resolved, making sure that we get more water, food, and ultimately people in here to support the nearly 600 people that are at the welfare centre.
Patients will continue for days as aftershocks and bad weather continue to delay recovery efforts.
November 13 was the one-year mark since the Paris attacks. 130 people were murdered by gunmen at a sold-out concert at the Bataclan. It was the most deadly event France had seen since World War II. President François Hollande led a remembrance ceremony at the sites of the attacks. Sting performed at the reopening of the Bataclan. According to a poll in the French newspaper Le Parisien, 59% of French people say the attacks have forever changed the way they view life.
One of the subjects of the Netflix series Making a Murderer will be released from jail. Brendan Dassey received life in prison for helping his uncle Stephen Avery kill a photographer in 2005. Making a Murderer, released last winter, put into question how the police handled the case. In August, a judge ruled that police coerced Dassey into confessing and overturned his conviction. The same judge ordered his release on Monday. Prosecutors say they plan to appeal.
Last year, the public learned Volkswagen had programmed 11 million cars with software to cheat emission tests. On Sunday, VW admitted that Audi cars with automatic transmissions have technology that allows them to do the same. Justin Chandler has the story.
Audi is owned by Volkswagen, which says automatic Audi models have software allowing them to produce less pollutants during testing than when driving. This means Audi was promoting cars as greener than they really were. The software is different than that found in VW cars in 2015. Ryerson Prof Corey Searcy says consumers are more willing to forgive accidental rule breaking than lying.
In this case, it does look like there was an act of deception. And I think that's what differentiates this from typical violations that we would see.
Ryerson Prof Vanessa Magnus calls what VW did organized fraud.
I'd like to say I believe that all companies' managers are strong environmentalists and they would never do anything like that, but I don't believe that. I believe that by and large, most companies would like to do whatever they could do if it made them money. But I also realize that most managers are realistic enough to realize that they can't.
Magnus says this sort of cheating undermines consumer trust.
There are societal demands, societal expectations, that in order for a company to have a social license, that companies have to aspire, at least try, to meet these expectations.
In the United States, VW was ordered to buy back affected vehicles as part of a class action settlement. Reporting for Ryerson Newsnight, I'm Justin Chandler.
A Hamilton judge who came under fire for wearing a Donald Trump hat to court apologized for his actions today. Judge Bernier Zabel said the act was a lapse in judgment and he did not mean it as a political statement. The incident was reported last week. Since then, a Hamilton city councilor called for the judge to be removed. The Hamilton Spectator reports that a complaint against Zabel has been filed with the Ontario Judicial Council.
What started with deceptive emails and calls from criminals is now happening by text message. Text message fraud is a growing problem in Canada. 767 Canadians have already fallen victim to text message fraud this year. According to the Anti-Fraud Center, and the center estimates that they only hear about 5% of these frauds. It seems sending these out to hundreds of thousands of people at a time is becoming increasingly simpler, as in 2014, there were only 211 victims.
A Porter Airlines plane narrowly avoided a mid-air crash yesterday with what may have been a drone. Pilots sent the plane into a sudden dive to avoid an object in their path. The plane was above Lake Ontario near Toronto when the near miss happened. Two flight attendants received minor injuries. The Transportation Safety Board said it's unclear if the object was actually a drone, but if so, it would have been flying well above the legal limit.
About 27% of children living in Toronto are living in poverty. Natasha Herman is live in the studio talking more about this crisis.
Toronto is labeled the Child Poverty Capital of Canada. It was reported yesterday that there are 133,000 children in the city living in poverty. You wouldn't think that families living just a few blocks from the expensive downtown core would be living in poverty. Almost 60% of these children living in poverty are grouped within Regent Park. This neighborhood was part of a revitalization project known for low-income living and community housing. But this percentage is double of the average poverty rate of children in Toronto. Why does this matter? Families living in poverty are not able to afford programs for their children like daycare, extra learning courses, and sports and arts programs. The Toronto District School Board reported that almost half of children who are a part of families earning less than $30,000 a year do not participate in activities outside of school. How is this fair? All children should be able to participate in the same programs. Their learning abilities should not be determined by financial security. I'm Natasha Herman. Back to you in the studio.
Thanks, Natasha. Health Quality Ontario released a report today that patients aren't waiting as long in emergency rooms. It was stated that for a majority of patients, their average wait time has been reduced from 3.6 hours to 3 hours. It also found that over the past 7 years, there has been a decline in the amount of time the majority of patients spent in the emergency. The report says that the shorter wait times for emergency doctors come despite an ever-increasing number of patients and a higher number of more seriously ill people.
Despite the unseasonally warm weather, the flu is still on its way to Toronto. CBC reports that flu season is in full swing on the west coast of Canada, making its way east quickly. Reporters Andrew Marshall asked Ryerson students if they were getting the flu shots this year.
Thousands of students sharing classrooms makes Ryerson's campus a hotbed for illness. This flu season, some students are wondering if getting a flu shot is worth the time and effort. For students like Andre Vardy, the flu shot is not a priority.
I guess my family doesn't believe in it, and I think it, I don't know, I just never got it, and I've never really had the flu before, so I guess I'm pretty good. Healthy guy over here, so.
Students like Tia Morrison prefer a holistic approach.
Because I don't need it. No, I know natural remedies. Marshmallow, thyme, and sage tea mixed together. Those leaves are really good. And lots of vitamin C. And what else do I do? Oh, spit out all the phlegm.
Aaron Krause sees the flu shot as an essential yearly treatment.
I love getting the flu shot because I feel like I don't get as sick as if I hadn't gotten the flu shot. When you move in to Pittman, everyone kind of gets the Pittman flu where everyone is sick for about a week. So I think it's a good idea to get the flu shot together. So my parents both work in pharmaceuticals, so they've always felt that the flu shot was super valuable, and that's a value that they passed on to me.
Kevin Young is undecided whether it's healthier to get the flu shot or let your immune system do the work for you.
You get a flu shot, you don't end up with anything. You don't know whether it's because of the flu shot or if it's just because you didn't get it, but, you know, why not?
The Ryerson Medical Center is offering flu shots to students by appointment, with open slots available tomorrow morning. The cost is covered by OHIP. Ryerson has explicitly told nursing students to stay home if they have flu-like symptoms. For Newsnight, I'm Anders Marshall.
This morning, Vincent van Gogh's recently discovered sketchbook was supposed to be published worldwide as what was described as one of the biggest art world discoveries in years. Bogmola Welsh-Ovkhorov, a retired University of Toronto art history professor and a noted expert on van Gogh, found the sketchbook in Arles, France. The Van Gogh Museum has since debunked its authenticity. They have stated that the sketchbook did not belong to the artist at all.
It's Tibet Week here on campus. The student group for Free Tibet at Ryerson is celebrating in the Student Learning Center. Our very own Daniel Marino has the story.
Tenzin Kelyeg left her home in Tibet where monks and supporters face persecution in China. She explains how their human rights are being violated.
For Larungar, it's a Buddhist institution that's one of the largest, it is the largest actually in the world, that houses over 10,000 monks and nuns. However, they've in the past, recently they've been evicted and forced, and this whole site's being demolished by the Chinese government. This is again without any of their consent or without any compensation.
Kaliang is now a student here at Ryerson.
And we're a student group that advocates for Tibet and Tibetans and Tibetans inside Tibet regarding the human rights violation as well as the cultural genocide going on. So at Ryerson, mainly we work to raise awareness and educate our fellow Ryersonians because a lot of them don't know about Tibet.
One main goal of the event is to share the culture of Tibet with students.
We're showcasing all the different parts of the culture as well as history as well as the current situation. So having the monks come in and do the mandala, it's showcasing our religion and they have an opportunity to speak personally to the monks.
Through a translator, a monk explains why educating youth about Tibet is important.
We came here to actually share the issue about Tibet. Since we've lost our country, we find it's very important to participate in such events that are organized by Students for Free Tibet to share with the wider audience and also the students about the situation in Tibet.
Tibet Week in the SLC will be happening every day from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. until Friday. For Newsnight, I'm Daniel Marino.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Tusho.
And I'm Rachel Arhin. And now to current affairs.
Good evening, Toronto. This is your host, Lamis Wajahat, coming to you with the current affairs. We've got some amazing features lined up and an interview with the Ryerson organization, Gimme 360. More on that later. We've got a story in a local Toronto neighborhood. If you've ever walked east of Ryerson, you've felt the air shift. Girard Street East is home to an interesting mix of crime, many of the city's homeless and plenty of Ryerson students. It's where members of our team, Emma McIntosh and Morgan Bochnick, both live. For the pilot episode of their podcast, Take a Walk on the Girard Side, they're taking us on a tour of their neighborhood, past and present. Take it away, guys.
See you guys later.
Yeah, sure. Like.
Bye. This is Sean Campbell. Sean's in his third year at Ryerson University, but he just moved to this house in September. This is what his walk to class is like.
I'll see like a crazy cat fight. I'll see like two people like mumbling swear words to themselves and then think they're talking to one another and then get in a crazy fight. I'll see like a person walk down the street with empty huge duffel bags, swinging them around, singing to themselves.
Sean's place is a block away from ours, near the intersection of Girard and Sherbourne Streets in Toronto. If you've ever seen it, you know we live in a pretty bad neighborhood, or at least a weird one. That's what we're here to talk about. I'm Morgan Bochnick.
And I'm Emma McIntosh. Welcome to Girard Street East.
There's just like so much going on here, but then at the same time, there's like young professionals making a ton of money just living like down every street. I really don't know where all these crazy people inhabit. Like, where do they live? Do they just live on the street? Do they live above these like convenience stores? I guess they live in places like this.
Today, the stretch of Girard between Ryerson University and Cabbage Town is notoriously unsafe. Assaults, thefts and robberies are common. We hear stabbings and gunshots once in a while, too. Sergeant Chu Chang has been working the Toronto Police's 51 Division, the downtown one, which includes our neighborhood, since 2009. He said what he sees varies from block to block, but it generally isn't good. The day before we talked with him, there was a stabbing a few blocks south of us at Queen and Sherbourne.
There's a lot of homelessness, transient people, a lot of drug use. A lot of panhandlers and squeegees. We have, domestics and lots of thefts. And so, you know, it runs the gamut. We get a lot of different things.
It wasn't always this way. In the 1800s, this neighborhood was a pretty swanky place. The land was owned by the fabulously wealthy Allen family. They're the namesakes of the Allen Gardens Park at Girard and Jarvis. In the 1850s, the Allens started building homes on the land and renting them out. And not just any houses. They were grand, red brick, Victorian-style mansions. The neighborhood quickly became one of the most upscale areas in the city.
We dug some photos of late 19th century Girard Street East out of the City of Toronto archives.
This is what your street used to look like.
No way! No! That's crazy. This is way cooler. This is right here.
That's Sean again. He was a little shocked, which is understandable. The photos show clean, empty sidewalks and sparkling new houses. They barely look like the scummy street we know and love today.
See, that looks nice. I don't know. This doesn't look nice. Like, this street looks run down and shanty.
So, how did we get here? Well, in the late 19th century, the other parts of Toronto started to develop, and the rich people moved north. As areas like Rosedale started to grow, the grandeur of Girard and Jarvis fizzled out. In the next few decades, shelters and boarding houses began to open in the old mansions. It all went downhill from there. Patricia Aldridge, known as Patty, said the neighborhood was then much worse than it is now. She's lived here since the 80s.
When we first moved in, there was no fence in the backyard to separate them from us. And we would find used condoms, hypodermic needles, all kinds of stuff in the yard.
Patty owns Take a Walk on the Wild Side. It's a shop aimed at outfitting drag performers, trans women, and she says many of the sex workers who frequent the area.
I've seen the woman who has their thigh highs and they're sort of like a patent leather with like a big stiletto. Are those from here?
Yeah. That was her on the phone.
Yeah?
Oh.
Patty says most of the problems in the neighborhood seem to stem from George Street. In particular, she points to Seton House, one of the biggest homeless shelters in the city.
Everyone in their house is addicted to drugs. They're all crazy. Their stuff gets stolen. It's dirty. They have cockroaches and bed bugs.
Patty isn't alone in that theory. Here's how Sean describes the residents of George Street.
They're like down a slippery slope till their death, man.
Sean's roommate, Paul Osinski, has a more nuanced view.
There's just a lot of people there that were hanging around, and you're kind of curious as to what their intentions are because it just kind of looked like they're standing there. It looks like it's really isolated from the rest of Toronto, too. Like, this weird little sketchy island.
But everyone has their stories about the street. Here's one from Sean and Paul's other roommate, McLean DeWeaver.
There's this one guy, and he has his girlfriend. I think her name is Shrek. And they're always arguing and yelling at each other. And he's always yelling, Shrek! Shrek!
So what's next for this area? Next year, the city plans to clear out Seton House and send the residents elsewhere. They're also trying to build a new LGBT-focused sports center at the same intersection where that stabbing happened, Queen and Sherbourne. People like Patty say that's a good thing.
You know, rich people would go to a psychiatrist. What do poor people do? It's almost like, we don't want them here. But it's a terrible thing to say that.
People like Helen Jefferson Lansky don't agree. Helen's a member of the Queer Trans Community Defense, a group that's against what they say is gentrification of the area. Gentrification is the process of renovating an area to suit middle-class tastes. However, doing so usually raises the cost of living and pushes the lower class out. That's what Helen says is going on in this neighborhood.
So a Seton House is slated to be demolished and replaced with a building that would only have about, I think, a third of the number of beds that they currently have. And the other homeless people would sort of be shipped out to the suburbs, which is not their community, their neighborhood. It's an alien neighborhood for many people who've spent their whole lives in the downtown.
But whether we like it or not, change is already happening.
Like, you can even see it on this street. Like, just those businesses down the street are, like, all, like, trendy, like, vintage antique stores and, like, cool barbershop. So, I don't know. You see it happening already.
That's the show. I'm Morgan Bochnick.
And I'm Emma McIntosh. Tune in next week.
We'll be talking about crime.
The cost of childcare in Toronto has become an unmanageable expense for the majority of Toronto families. With three-fourths of parents unable to afford licensed childcare, they are being forced to consider other options. Reporter Sawyer Bogdan has more on the story.
Oh, that's him. Sorry. Hi, Bug, where are you? Okay. Just making sure you're safe. Okay, love you, bye. My name is Stephanie. I'm Richie's mom. He's 11 years old. I'm a bartender and server.
He's very happy and he wants to speak to his younger brother. So sometimes he uses his body language.
My name is Zhang Yu and I'm 30 years old and I have two children. One is 22 months, one is 4 months. And because I need to go to university, so I need to place my elder son to the daycare.
In a time where the stay-at-home mom has become a thing of the past, the demand for childcare is more prevalent than ever before. In a recent article by the Toronto Star, it was determined that 3/4 of parents in Toronto cannot afford licensed daycare, leaving the parents with very few options, trying to juggle the high cost versus quality of care.
Well, price, first of all. Before my father moved in with us, it was a little difficult because a lot of places don't take children under a year old. So he was 11 months old. Now, though, since Richie was 2.5, my father has lived with us. It's kind of a toss-up. Either it's you pay more for rent to have somebody else live with you, or, you know, you pay for childcare. So I chose the latter. We have a 3-bedroom apartment now, so Dad is with us full-time.
You had looked into putting her son in the Ryerson daycare, but had to find a more affordable option farther away when she found out it would cost almost $2,000 a month.
You know, in my family, just my husband at work is at work. I don't have any income. Yeah. So $1,000 is a little bit expensive, but as an immigrant in Canada, my education background in China, yeah, does not confirm here, so I cannot find a better job other than in the supermarket. So I need to go to university again, and so that I can get a better job after I graduate.
Traditionally in China and other cultures, grandparents and other family members help to raise the children, something that you and many other immigrants don't have after moving to a new country.
Many friends of me, they also have a child, but both the parents need to go to work. So there's not grandparents that help them to take care of the children, so they need to place their children to the daycare. Sometimes I really don't want to place him to the daycare, really, yeah, but I have no choice.
There he is. Hey, it's just your boy. Go see him. Go get him. Go get him.
First of all, do you have homework?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Okay.
Up now?
Yes.
For Richie and his mom, having Richie's grandfather help raise him has created a closer relationship between the two.
It's good and bad at sometimes. good because me and him have, a good situation, like a good relationship between each other, not just grandson and grandfather. It's more than that. We're like friends. We talk about a lot of different things. But the bad side is because we're together so much, we get in a bit of arguments sometimes. But that's mostly it.
We've actually been able to have a lot more opportunities for Richie because I work really weird hours. My dad's home to help him out with extracurriculars and stuff. He does acting, acting classes, what we're going to at 6:30 tonight. He will be in a production later this month called It's a Wonderful Life. So because of that, when I'm working, my dad takes him to auditions and to projects and stuff. He's also made the rep soccer team, so that's twice a week as well. And he does karate once a week. So if I didn't have my dad around, Richie wouldn't be able to do any of that.
Until a more economic option can be found, parents like you and Gordon are going to need to continue finding alternative solutions for affordable childcare.
A clothing startup from Ryerson's Fashion Zone combines fashion with virtual reality and charity. I caught up with two of the founders of Gimme 360, Josiah Crombie and Lucas Bruno. Hi guys, it's Lamise, and I'm with the founders of Gimme 360.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
So, to start with, can you tell us a bit about the company Gimme 360?
Yeah, if you want, I'll get right to that. I know, I'll usually start with how we began. So, me and Josiah, my co-founder, we actually worked for charities in high school, and a lot of people would ask us, you know, where's the money going? And it was kind of weird, because even us as employees, we didn't even really know, and when we'd ask our bosses or our superiors, even they wouldn't know. So we started this based on a transparency outlook where we wanted to show people exactly where their money was going. And that's the whole premise of Gimme 360, to show the consumer or the donor exactly where their money is going in a really cool way.
Okay. So what type of clothes do you guys sell? Because that's what we learned about you.
Yeah, so what we do is we sell apparel that gives back. And then for each apparel item we sell, it has a chip inside of it, and you can hover your phone on it, and it'll pull up a virtual reality video to where a portion of your purchase goes. So it's a lot like Tom's Shoes, but we show you where your impact is. So we sell Flyknit hoodies, classic joggers, and Scoop bamboo tees.
Okay. The idea of integrating virtual reality into your clothing, where did that come from?
Well, going back to what Lucas said, we're all about transparency and showing you and humanizing the issue. It's one thing to hear about people not having clean water or the impact you make, but to actually see it is very emotional. So we wanted to build that emotional aspect to our apparel, and we thought virtual reality was the right technology to do that with.
So you're talking about the sort of chips that people can scan. What exactly do they see once they scan this?
So basically, as soon as you tap your phone on our proprietary label, it'll redirect you to a YouTube link. And this is a private link that'll show you where your clothing is made. So you'll be in the mill, you'll see how it's made, you'll meet all the workers, and then you'll actually be on a plane going to Cambodia with us, and we'll guide you through how the water is filtered and the people you're actually helping. So it's a really cool story that you go along with. Yeah. So
it takes you to the school, the entrepreneurs that bottle the water, filtrate it, and deploy it. So it's really exciting. And the labels are completely waterproof and durable.
That's awesome. How many people have you been able to help so far?
So, I'll answer that one. Okay. We've done 4 projects in Uganda, and we've actually been able to help over 1,000 people. But the current project that we're helping right now or supporting will help over 300,000. So it's definitely a big step.
Okay. And I understand that you have donated 20% of your proceeds in your recent project to Cambodia.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's amazing. What does the company have planned for the future?
Yeah, so we want to do many projects in many different locations. So eventually expanding beyond just water projects. We think apparel is a lot representative of who you are. So we want people to wear their heart on their sleeve and be able to choose what they support.
That's great. Thank you guys so much for joining us and telling us all that amazing information.
Thanks.
Thank you for having us. Yeah.
It's great.
November is a stressful time for students, and that means mental health takes a center stage. Luke Filmer, a Ryerson film student, started his road to recovery by creating his feature film, a movie that is generating attention in the Canadian film industry. Our reporter Serena Kwok brings you the story.
It's your father's funeral.
I can memorialize that on my own. I don't need to be surrounded by a bunch of fake pricks pretending that they give a shit about him.
What's your problem?
I don't have a problem. Get the fuck out of my way.
You're acting like a little girl.
I'll call security.
What you just heard was a climatic scene between Goliath's two leads, a full-length feature film that students across Ryerson University worked on. Luke Vilmaire, a fourth-year film student, was the brainchild behind the whole project.
So I've been interested in screenwriting since I was young, and I knew that film was an area that I wanted to go into. And I find that there's a lot of opportunity in writing to really explore stories and things that you're dealing with personally as well. For me, it was a big decline in my mental health last year, and Goliath was my way of kind of coping with and exploring that. So the story follows a woman named Robin Walker who returns home to her small town after years away to bury her father for his funeral. And she kind of has a tumultuous relationship with her siblings that she's trying to repair ahead of the funeral. My dad is alive, so it's not necessarily based on my life, but a lot of the things that the main character is going through are things that I think a lot of people who have experienced mental illness will be able to relate to, and hopefully people who haven't will be able to empathize and understand a little bit more about it. I think one of the greatest things about this project is that it's opened so many doors for a lot of the people involved, and it continues to have an impact on people who are coming to me and asking me how I was able to do it. And it's great to be able to sit down with students, other students, my peers, and tell them about the process and the lessons I learned and the mistakes that I made, and hopefully inspire and encourage them to do the same.
Mental health plays a huge part in the world of Goliath. The writing actually hits close to home. Because although it's silent and invisible, Luke lives with depression and borderline personality disorder.
So what that means is I have difficulty regulating how I'm feeling on a day-to-day basis. And that was explored through the film, through the character of Robin Walker. And it's something that me and Jessica Sipos, who plays the lead, discussed a lot in the months leading up to it because we wanted to make sure that we did a really accurate portrayal of someone who would be going through these experiences. Because I think there's really a lack of positive portrayals of people with mental illness in the media. I think as a filmmaker and someone who's experienced thoughts of suicide and self-harm, it was important for me to show that you can come back from that and you can really do big things. And a lot of people have told me that, you know, Goliath, this project's too ambitious and you should not be doing it this early in your career, but I didn't listen to them. And because I didn't, all these great doors have opened for me, and I think we created a film that I'm really proud of.
Helping Luke throughout his recovery was a clothing company called Wear Your Label that tackles the stigma of mental health through their clothing. Not only has he joined their marketing team, but Wear Your Label is actually a part of the Joe Fresh Center for Fashion Innovation, a center that is based out of Ryerson.
Wear Your Label was started out of New Brunswick by Kyle and Kaylee, who I've grown to know and are great people to work with. I'm excited about kind of the impact the brand has had on Canadians and people worldwide. It's exciting to see people having these conversations about mental illness based on t-shirts that they see people wearing. Some of the slogans, for example, are self-care isn't selfish, it's okay not to be okay, sad but rad. Being a part of Wear Your Label, it came at, again, a very convenient time. I was going through a lot of difficulties in my own personal life, and I was lucky enough to have a project like Goliath to lean back on.
The budget for the film totaled at $200,000, but it was the initial $20,000 funding from the Ryerson Communication and Design Society that caused a controversy on campus. Luke was our vice president of finance last year, and he breaks down the conflict of interest and whether the money he received was fair.
I think at the end of the day, it's fair that people would have concerns about it being in a position of power to be pitching for this money. Yes, although there was kind of the negative press surrounding it and the questions asked, what excited me is that people were asking questions and that people knew about the project funding, because I think it was an untapped resource in the RCDS. And one of my goals as VP Finance was to make people more aware of it. Now, when I was elected to the position, I did not realize Goliath was even a thing in my heart. I didn't know that it would be something I'd be making this early in my career. I thought it would be more 4 or 5 years down the line. But again, because of the personal things going on in my life at the time, I felt in a sense that I had nothing to lose by going ahead and pursuing this ambitious project years earlier than I had originally anticipated. So I asked the staff advisor, Mary Macon at the time, and Casey Ewan, who was the president, if it would be okay for me to pitch, if executives have done it before, or if it would be a conflict of interest. And they assured me that it would be fine as long as I was not present in the room during deliberation and I was not given access to the meeting minutes, both of which ended up happening. I went in, I pitched like every other student, and I left the room. The board deliberated and in the end voted in favor of funding Goliath. And at the end of the day, RCDS was just 20 grand of that 200,000. And it was the first 20 grand. And I'm really grateful for that because it definitely started a snowball effect and other people were more willing to back a project that had the support of a student society like that.
The future for Goliath and Luke's upcoming project is bright as the film industry is charting and noticing his tremendous talent and work.
Because of kind of the impact and the connections that I made from Goliath, I'm now moving forward with a TV series that I'm entitling Dark Horse. So Goliath will either be released at a summer or a fall festival, and then theatrically, most likely in the spring of next year.
Look out for Goliath next year in theaters and festivals and dive into the vibrant world Luke Vermeer has created for them. I'm Serena Kwok.
Madonna, Dennis, and I check out talked about spots in the city to see if they're actually worth the hype. Listen to our first podcast, which is called Worth the Hype, where we review Au Noir. Will it shine or does it just stay in the dark?
Hey, I'm Lamise.
And I'm Madonna.
Toronto's full of unique places.
Lot of hype.
But are they worth it?
Today, we're checking out Au Noir.
Where you dine in the dark.
Do they cook in the dark?
Let's head to the kitchen.
Ethan Smith has been a chef here for about a year.
He loves the concept of not seeing your food.
Yeah, texture and smell is a big thing, especially because they can't see the food. Getting the seasoning right to make ensure that the beef has the proper texture all the time and make sure that the portobello mushrooms are cooked throughout and crispy on the outside. But it's all about that kind of feeling, you know what I mean? The smell and the texture of the food is a big thing, especially in the dark.
There is a preset menu at Au Noir, but they also offer another option.
The really cool thing is giving people the surprise starters that we have. Just the overall aroma and the smell is really nice, especially in the dark. They can't see what they're eating, so the smell is really nice. We get to kind of surprise them and make whatever we feel like, make something interesting, and see if they can guess.
He's made surprises from scotch eggs to alligator tacos, and people had no idea what they were eating.
Yeah, people don't know what to expect of that. It tastes like chicken. People think it's chicken. Nope. Alligator.
So we decided to take the risk.
After being told to switch our phones off and hide anything that could emit light,
we were taken into the room.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Yeah. Good. Single file and left hand, left shoulder. Go on the right side. Please switch your hand right hand, right shoulder. Our left is on the left side, go on the left. There's a wall on the left. Next person, you please follow me. We are going across her, okay?
Okay.
So this is your chair. Let me pull it. Have a seat. There's
Thank
a wall
you.
Here. Okay?
Thanks.
It was dark. My first instinct when I got my plate was to touch my food. Like, actually feel it with my fingers.
Yeah, I was pretty worried about how I was going to eat.
I keep bringing the food towards my mouth and it just falls off the fork.
All the servers are visually impaired. Tracy, who's been here for 7 years, is partially blind.
It's really about, you know, opening up your other senses and also trying to see what it's like to live this life even for an hour and a half and really consider, you know, what people go through.
I feel like people know that about Au Noir, but does it actually help?
Job. It's very, very difficult to get a job with a disability, with vision loss in this city. The only people that hire people like that are big companies like banks. Small companies like this really don't take a chance on people with disabilities, so that's because they think it's going to cost them money, that they'll have to bring in separate, you know, devices. And so it was tough. And I had a job and I got laid off, and so then I was out of work for a while, and so this has been a savior for me.
We were definitely feeling the effects of not being able to see.
What am I eating?
What is that? Oh, it's the whole plate. I thought it was a vegetable or something.
Au Noir definitely provides a unique experience for someone with 20/20 vision. The atmosphere is interesting and the staff are phenomenal people.
Yeah, I think after talking to people who work there, they all have a positive experience, whether or not they had their full sight. I found myself reflecting more during dinner because I couldn't see anything, not even you.
Hey, Madonna.
Hey, what? Good.
Thanks.
So, I think we've come to a conclusion. We think it was worth the hype. This was Lamise.
And Madonna.
For Newsnight. And for sports, DeRozan's been playing out of his mind while contract issues threaten to break up the Blue Jays. We've got some Jamaican bobsled in there too. More with Notion.
Thanks, Lamise. It's been a historic start to the season for the Raptors. Star player DeMar DeRozan's average scores are at a level not seen since Michael Jordan in the 90s. 9 games into the season, DeRozan is averaging 34 points a game, which is the highest a Raptor has ever averaged. It's also the highest in the league right now. Hopes are high to beat the Cavaliers in Cleveland tonight as they run on a 2-game winning streak. And the Leafs are playing in Toronto tonight. They'll face off against the Nashville Predators. It's been a slow start to the season for the team. They've lost their last two games, and controversy is still flying over centerman Nazem Kadri's blindside hit last week. They'll try to pick up the pieces tonight. And the Blue Jays will be waving goodbye to star players Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion. A last-ditch effort to retain them wasn't accepted. Bautista is putting an end to a mammoth 8-year relationship with the Blue Jays, capping it all off with 2 playoff runs in their last 2 seasons. He has yet to find another team, while rumors have Encarnacion possibly heading to the Boston Red Sox. And in international sports, there's controversy again in Formula One. Race organizers stood by their decision to red flag the race during an extreme downpour of rain. Drivers and teams argued whether the race should have been stopped, but organizers near crashes as a reason to stop the race multiple times. Lewis Hamilton took the win, which keeps his championship hopes alive. Here's what he had to say about the driving conditions on Sunday.
You know, I was generally just chilling up front. When it rains, that's usually a good day for me. And today was tricky for everyone. There was definitely opportunities for aquaplaning, which everyone did. But I want to say a big thank you to my team. You know, this is we're creating history in this team this year. The stuff that we've done.
The season finale takes place in Abu Dhabi 2 Fridays from now. Competition between sports teams can get ugly sometimes, but Canada seems to want to help out its competition. On Saturday, Jamaica's bobsled team was headed to Canada Olympic Park, but their vehicle suddenly broke down on the side of a Calgary road, leaving them stranded before their next race. Luckily, a Calgary rental company is providing the team with a free van. The team headed to Whistler, BC early this morning to compete. One member says the team is so excited about the help they received.
When we got the call from Driving Force stepping in to not only provide us a vehicle, but also donations for food and gas, we were just so excited to know that, you know, people are willing to just lend a hand and get us there to qualify for the Olympics and just, you know, show all that support and really push for us to do well.
Hopefully they do well, but not as well as the Canadian team, though. For Newsnight, I'm Nushin Ziafati.
Thanks, Nushin. And that's all we have for tonight, Toronto. Thanks so much for listening. This has been Lamise Wajahat for November 15th, Newsnight.